It is Friday, November 17th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, embattled Zimbabwean President Robert Mugabe makes a public appearance. What did President Donald Trump learn on his just-completed Asia trip? We get perspective from our White House correspondent.
He spoke about trade at every single stop during the trip.
And Washington's new Museum of the Bible prepares to open. It's all ahead. Zimbabwe's President Robert Mugabe made a public appearance Friday, his first since the military took over state institutions and opened talks aimed at getting the aged leader to resign. Mugabe, wearing an academic gown, presided over a university graduation ceremony for more than 1,000 students in Harare. The 93-year-old Mugabe is reported to be resisting demands from the army and members of his own ZANU-PF party to step down after 37 years in power. VOA's Southern Africa correspondent Anita Powell spoke to me about Mugabe's public appearance Friday.
It's an interesting definition of house arrest when the guy under house arrest is out and about in public handing out diplomas. But indeed he did. He appeared at a graduation ceremony and handed out diplomas to college graduates, including, it must be noted, the wife of the general who led the movement to take over the television station and take Mr. Mugabe into custody in the first place. Everybody's related, I guess, in these elite circles in Zimbabwe. So, yes, he did attend. He fell asleep at the podium. And people were very surprised to see him.
So at the moment, apparently negotiations are underway between the military and Mugabe as regards Zimbabwe and Mugabe's future?
Right. So negotiations are underway, not just between Mugabe and the military, but also other actors who are involved. And that would include political actors. That includes a few religious figures. That also includes mediators from South Africa. And yeah, the end goal is to get President Mugabe to accept he is no longer going to be the president, to get him to say, you know, thanks, it's been great, and step aside peacefully. But it's pretty clear that that is not what is happening. We're closing in now on about 72 hours since tanks first rolled through Harare, and he's showing no sign of being willing to step down.
Well, this seems to be then a standoff. This could perhaps go for a while longer.
Yes, and it's very interesting because Zimbabwe is a highly educated country with great respect for law, for process. And so what this kind of comes down to, interestingly enough, is this is a semantic and legal battle that's going on right now in Zimbabwe. And I think the military perhaps, I don't know how this is possible, that they could underestimate Robert Mugabe, but he is a canny negotiator and he knows his laws and his rules inside and out. What they're fighting over right now, I think, and this is just from the messaging we've been hearing from those who are allowed to speak, and those are people who are on the side of the military action, is that this is not a coup. And they are stressing this, and there is a very good reason that they're stressing this. They are saying that this is not a coup. This is a democratic correction that the military made, and they are trying to persuade the president to step down. They're not forcing him out of power. They are persuading him to agree on a path forward. The reason this cannot be a coup in there as part of their narrative is that if this were to be a coup, the African Union and the Southern African Development Community would have to take an automatic hardline stance. They would have to suspend the membership of Zimbabwe and they would have to impose sanctions, which is a key point because many of Zimbabwe's powerful elite who are involved in this entire effort, a lot of them have residences outside of Zimbabwe, especially in South Africa. So if they were sanctioned, then a lot of the key players in this drama would lose a lot of important material things. They would lose access. They would lose maybe a bit of influence. And they would be very much sidelined. And so they're fighting against that. What Mugabe is doing is he appears to be trying to run the clock out until the Southern African Development Community meets on Sunday. Because if he can make this look like a coup, if he can convince them that this is a coup, then they have to come out against it, which will give him support.
Fascinating. Really fascinating.
I know, and there's not a shorter way to explain this. It's it's a very complicated situation, and it does fall down to a lot of semantics and the importance of appearances. And that's partially why President Mugabe did show up as President Mugabe at the graduation today, because the military group that led this action, they had stressed that he will be allowed dignity and respect. And that is just one way of showing that he maintains dignity and respect.
What about the role of the war veterans from the country's independence struggle? Apparently, they are very much against Mr. Mugabe.
Yes, they've become increasingly outspoken in recent years. And yes, they are against Mr. Mugabe, but they did come to South Africa, I want to say about a week ago, and the leader of the association said, you know, we're going to challenge this democratically. We're not in favor of any sort of unconstitutional action. But now that guy is back in Harare, and he is praising the effort. It's clear that this action, sending tanks down the street, taking over national television, is within his moral framework.
What do the Zimbabwean powers that be at the moment, what do they think of the mediation that is taking place?
So the mediation is being led by the Southern African Development Community, and those inside Zimbabwe are very, very harsh on SADC, because SADC, they say, completely allowed Mugabe to have his way in the wake of the violent 2008 elections. And they failed Zimbabwe, they say. They failed to push for constitutional reform. They failed to be a little harder on Mugabe. And they basically allowed Zimbabwe to get to the situation that it's in today.
Interesting.
So they would like SADC to not be involved. They would like SADC to allow Zimbabwe to sort itself out. Although, if you want to be cynical, you could also say that they want SADC to not be involved because they don't want SADC to weigh in and call it a coup. Because if they call it a coup, then these very people who are able to fly into South Africa at a moment's notice, they will be sanctioned and limited.
What is the role of Grace Mugabe, Mr. Mugabe's wife, in all of this?
So the one result I hope we can safely say out of this entire debacle is that, at the very least, a large portion of Zimbabwe's ruling elite and the military has made it abundantly clear that they will not tolerate Grace Mugabe's ascendancy to political power. That has been made abundantly clear. And I guess Grace Mugabe, depending on what assets and power she has at her disposal, may choose to disregard that. But she has now seen a strong show of force that says your presidential ambitions are out of line and will not be tolerated. And so this could be a decisive end to her political ambitions. It's going to be very difficult, I think, now for Robert Mugabe, even if he continues, to be able to justify giving Grace the vice presidency, which basically is a heartbeat away in a 93-year-old man, a heartbeat away from the presidency. So this could put an end to her ambitions.
That's VOA Southern Africa correspondent Anita Powell reporting from Johannesburg, South Africa. Time now for social media. Well, today is National Take a Hike Day, and that's hashtag National Take a Hike Day. It's a time to encourage people to enjoy the great outdoors. Here in the U.S., there are some wonderful national parks to explore. The National Park Service Midwest tweets, "Take a hike in a park. Across the nation, miles of trails provide opportunities for all." Lisa Hamilton tweets, "So many trails to explore." She quotes the famous American naturalist John Muir saying, "Of all the paths you take in life, make sure some of them are dirt." And AT Conservancy tweets, "Happy hashtag National Take a Hike Day. It's a perfect day to spend some time outside hiking with others on the Appalachian Trail. What are your hiking plans for today?" Well, people are also tweeting about the new Museum of the Bible, which opens here in Washington tomorrow. We'll have more on that a bit later in the program. Jeremy Burton, who heads communications at the museum, tweets, "Tomorrow is the dedication of the Museum of the Bible. There is an amazing team getting this 430 square foot of wonder ready for you." The museum itself tweets, "There is a book, the Bible, worth all others ever printed." That's a quote from Patrick Henry. And that's a look at social media for today. Here are some of the top stories trending. A Belgian judge defers ruling on the extradition of ousted Catalan president Carles Puigdemont. Lebanon's Prime Minister Saad Hariri said he's been in Saudi Arabia for discussions on the future of the region. North Korea tells Reuters its nuclear program is a deterrent to cope with the threat of the United States, and U.S.-funded news outlets could be forced to register as foreign agents in Russia. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the VOAnews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
A new Brazilian study provides suggestions on how to keep cows happy. Farmers and ranchers maintain fenced-in areas or enclosures to corral their livestock when they need to weigh or vaccinate the herd. Most of the study's suggestions involve this corral environment. The researchers from Brazil's Institute of Animal Husbandry, Cierto Zeno, proposes that the best way to appease livestock is to remove bursts of color, objects that cast shadows, or water puddles from corrals. The study also found that keeping noise at low levels, as well as keeping your dogs out of the way and not using those electric prods, can also provide significant reduction in bovine stress. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, Washington's Museum of the Bible prepares to open. President Donald Trump this week returned from his 12-day five-nation trip to Asia. VOA White House correspondent Steve Herman accompanied Trump on the journey. I asked Steve about the main components of the president's trip.
I think it was two things. One was definitely North Korea, and the other was trade. He spoke about trade at every single stop during the trip. As far as North Korea and trade, I think it's TBD, to be determined just what are the outcomes of the trip. North Korea, obviously in Japan, South Korea in China, where he met with the leaders, and everybody was expressing a unified front to stop the development of North Korea's nuclear weapons and its the range of its ballistic missiles, although we really saw nothing specific or concrete, but certainly behind the scenes there was a lot of talk about strategizing and what other actions can be taken. And on trade, the president threw around a lot of big numbers, $300 billion, and then he said it could even be triple that, the resulting from the trip. And we saw some non-binding memoranda of understanding signed in both China and Vietnam, but there's some skepticism just what that will all really add up to. And so again, TBD, to be determined.
Mr. Trump has also spoken about his relationship with Chinese President Xi Jinping. He said they have a good personal relationship. But moving forward, particularly looking at the issues of trade, that could evolve.
Certainly. I think all indications are that over the period of the next several months, we are going to see this administration change the tough talk on trade to tough action on trade. That was something that it was very clear from the president's remarks and comments that other administration officials have been making, that the current huge trade deficit between the United States and China in China's favor is totally unacceptable. And as the president said, the Chinese have been getting away with a lot of things over the years. He doesn't blame the Chinese. They took advantage of a situation. He blames those in previous administrations, and he is vowing to rectify that. And so I would look for some very tough action to come out of the USTR, the U.S. Trade Representative, in the weeks and months ahead.
Well, in addition to the subjects we've already discussed, is there a part of this trip that really stood out in your mind?
Well, I think the fact that this president went over there and went to all these different countries, gave him firsthand opportunity not only to speak to these leaders, and besides the pageantry, which the president said he was very impressed with, felt that America and he was getting a lot of respect, but just being able to, when he's driving in the motorcades, and look out the window and see what the situation is on the streets. And in Asia, what you see these days is tremendous progress, huge infrastructure projects that have gone up. But also in some countries, there still is a lot of poverty. And for any leader to be able to see this firsthand and get a feel for what these places are like, I think is extremely valuable.
That's VOA White House correspondent Steve Herman. This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there. Bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's newsmaker interview program. Join us each Saturday and Sunday when we talk with authors, analysts, and policymakers who provide fresh insight on topics ranging from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. That's Press Conference USA, every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
This is International Edition. The world's best-selling book is the Bible, but the Holy Manuscript has been interpreted in different ways by different religions. In Washington, the new privately funded Museum of the Bible opens to the public on Saturday. Located near the U.S. Capitol, the $500 million museum features ancient artifacts, interactive displays, and Bibles from over the centuries. But as we hear from VOA's Deborah Block, the museum is also controversial.
Not surprisingly, the Museum of the Bible contains many different Bibles and songs about the Bible, stories from Hebrew texts, and even contemporary fashion designs with biblical themes. The Bible is significant because it helps people navigate through life, says Tony Zeiss, the museum's executive director.
Lessons to be learned there. So we're concentrating on its history, its narrative, and its impact. We would like for them to personally commit to becoming more engaged in this amazing book.
He says the museum is non-sectarian, and more than 100 scholars who represent various points of view designed the exhibits, which fill several floors in the large building. There are state-of-the-art interactive displays to educate people and keep them entertained, even in the elevators. And you can also stroll through a recreation of Nazareth, the town where Jesus grew up. The museum was founded by Steve Green of the conservative Christian evangelical family that owns Hobby Lobby, the world's largest privately owned arts and crafts retailer.
It would be hard for us as a family to try to hide what we believe. We believe this book is what it claims to be. But our role here is to present the facts of the Bible, more of it in a journalistic look.
But that's questionable, says John Fia, who considers himself a liberal evangelical Christian.
As much as they want to try to stay neutral, an objective take on the Bible, it's going to be very, very hard to present the Bible in that way, because the Bible is always so sort of ensconced, so connected to a particular religious tradition and their way of interpreting it.
Georgetown University professor Jacques Berlinerbrau, who is Jewish, believes the museum has a hidden agenda.
The idea that the museum doesn't have any intent to convert people to a particular reading of God, of Jesus Christ, of the Scripture, is absurd.
And Fia sees a hidden agenda in placing the museum in the nation's capital.
It's hard to see this as anything other than an attempt to try to bring Christian values and the Bible's teachings, as understood by evangelical Protestants like the Greens, into the center of American political life and American cultural life.
The museum contains impressive ancient artifacts, some on loan, others from the Greens' massive collection of antiquities, some of which, it turns out, were smuggled out of Iraq and purchased inadvertently by the family. The Greens forfeited the items and paid a $3 million fine. And Green told VOA the museum is willing to return artifacts to their home countries.
If there's any artifact that we have that they would have a claim, that's fine.
Museum officials are encouraging people to come to the museum and decide what they think for themselves. Deborah Block, VOA News, Washington.
Sounds like an interesting place to visit, and it's not too far away from VOA headquarters here. Well, in other news, Italian mafia boss Salvatore Todorina has died in a hospital prison ward in Parma, Italy, after battling cancer. He was 87 years old. Rina died early Friday, just hours after Italy's justice minister had permitted family members a bedside visit Thursday, which was his birthday. The so-called boss of bosses and one of the most feared godfathers of the Sicilian mafia, Rina was serving 26 life sentences for masterminding the assassinations of Italian prosecutors and law enforcement fighting the infamous Cosa Nostra mob. Rina directed the mob's criminal activity during more than 23 years that include bombings in Rome and more than 150 murders. He had been in a medically induced coma after two surgical interventions. The most high-profile murders he ordered were the assassinations in 1992 of two anti-mafia judges who had brought more than 300 mobsters to trial in 1987. And that is our show for today. Please remember to visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us. Have a great weekend.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States is in the midst of its most severe drug epidemic since the 1980s. Today, more people are dying from drug overdoses than from gun homicides and motor vehicles combined, said President Donald Trump.
Last year, we lost at least 64,000 Americans to overdoses. That's 175 lost American lives per day. That's 7 lost lives per hour in our country. Drug overdoses are now the leading cause of unintentional death in the United States by far.
Ending the epidemic will require mobilization of government, local communities, and private organizations. It will require the resolve of our entire country, said President Trump. The U.S. Department of State plays a key role in this effort. That's because the crisis is fueled by heroin and synthetic opioids that were produced overseas, while transnational criminal organizations moved this deadly product into the United States. For these reasons, the national strategy to respond to this crisis must include an international component, said Deputy Assistant Secretary for International Narcotics and Law Enforcement Affairs Jim Walsh. Already we are seeing some successes. At the request of the United States, the United Nations recently placed two chemicals used to make the drug, fentanyl, on an international list of controlled substances. Since 2015, due in part to U.S. requests, China has taken unprecedented action, controlling 138 narcotic substances. The State Department is also using foreign assistance to strengthen Mexico's capacity to interdict illegal drugs. This helps improve security along our shared border against the cross-border distribution of heroin and synthetic drugs. These efforts, along with a slew of new tools developed by the International Narcotics and Law Enforcement Bureau, which address addiction and demand for drugs, will also help address the opioid crisis domestically, said Deputy Assistant Secretary Walsh.
With over 64,000 Americans dead from overdoses since 2016, with drug traffickers taking advantage of new ways to move and sell their product, including through the dark web, and rogue chemists developing insidious new synthetic drugs at an alarming rate. We must constantly be adapting our approach and responding to new and deadly realities.
This challenge is a dire one, said Deputy Assistant Secretary Walsh, and it will continue to be a top priority for the department.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.